We are all connected to each other biologically, to the Earth chemically, and to the rest of the universe atomically. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada, approximately 150 light years from the edge of the local bubble, with 12 micrograms of the hydrogen per square centimeter in the way. How do we know what we know about what's out there? That we can chart the universe at all is a direct result of the fact that there is a great deal of matter that emits light of its own accord. It is these stars that we are seeing up in the night sky, alone, in pairs or higher multiples, all the way up to the larger globular clusters, who may count some hundreds of thousands of stars as members, or the galaxies themselves, containing hundreds of billions of dues-paying stellar citizens. But not every bit of matter in the universe is bright. From planets to dust grains to clouds of gas, much of the material of the universe is difficult to observe. Some of this stuff may never have been part of a star, but if the mass in question is present as atoms heavier than beryllium, you can be sure that it has been forged in a stellar furnace. These are the atoms that make up the planets, as well as every living being ever to walk ours or any other Earth. Thus, as Neil deGrasse Tyson was intimating in our opening quote, and as Carl Sagan has also noted, we are connected in the deepest ways. However, not every heavy element finds a planetary home. Many keep to themselves, quietly traveling through space. When this interstellar medium interacts with starlight, it leaves a signature in that star's spectrum, a signature that our guest tonight, Western professor Jan Kamme, has spent his academic career trying to characterize and to understand. While their presence is barely known to us, such particles have had interesting histories and interesting pathways of evolution. It is these molecules, ions, and atoms that fill the void everywhere underlying the universe that we observe. Transitioning us tonight to Dave Kirsch's interview is The Tao of Love by Vangelis.
Dr. Kamme, welcome to Western Worlds. Good to have you here.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So to begin with, a lot of your research utilizes molecular spectroscopy.
That's right.
So how about you tell us a little bit about what that is?
So spectroscopy is a technique that we use to study the chemical composition of all sorts of materials in space. And at the same time, we can also use it to learn something about the conditions like temperature, densities, that sort of things that are going on. It's something, the way that it works is we collect the light of typically remote objects like stars or sometimes entire galaxies. With a telescope, we will then pass the light through a prism, something like a prism. And what you get out is something that looks like a rainbow, but with all sorts of dark lines on there. If you carefully analyze those lines, that's like fingerprints of chemicals. And once you understand the fingerprints, there's even information in there about such things like temperature and condensities. So that's why I actually think it's interesting to use. It's a bit like CSI universe, so to speak.
Yeah, of course, this sort of technique is used on Earth and would be featured in CSI.
That's right.
So what sort of molecules do we detect?
We live in a molecular universe. We have detected in space all sorts of species from fairly small diatomics. For instance, one of the most abundant molecules is carbon monoxide, CO. silent killer on Earth. We find it in large quantities in a lot of environments in space because it is a molecule that you form quite easily, and once formed, it is very stable. But then we have found more than 150 molecules in space, ranging from fairly simple species to much more complex structures, and then the largest species that we know are the so-called fullerenes that have 60 and 70 carbon atoms.
So you implied that we could use this technique to look at pretty much anything. So what sort of things have you observed using molecular spectroscopy?
Right, well, I should probably take part of that back and be a bit more precise here. We can use molecular spectroscopy for a lot of different environments, but clearly only for environments where molecules can form and survive. And so typically that means that you're looking at not too hot and not too cold environments. If it's too cold, then most molecules will actually freeze onto dust grains. If it's too hot, you will dissociate the molecules. So what we're talking about is typically temperature of the order of maybe a few hundred degrees. So that's typically where you have rich molecular gas. I personally like to look most at old dying stars, because what happens there is a process that turns this atomic gas of an envelope, which is technically fairly simple, into a complex mixture of all sorts of very complex molecules that then get incorporated in deep space and interstellar medium, and then in the next generation of stars and planets. So sometimes we find some of these complex species in meteorites on Earth as well. And so that whole process where you take the outside envelope of a star and turn that gas into this complex mixture of sometimes fairly rich organic species even, that's something that I find very fascinating. And it's not something that we totally understand yet. So, but you can also use molecular spectroscopy to study what is commonly referred to as the interstellar medium. Really what it is, it's empty space, kind of the space between stars. It's not entirely empty, but there's not an awful lot of matter in that space. But one of the other things that I study with my research group is a very long-standing mystery. It's called the diffuse interstellar bands. And what it is again, we see a set of these spectroscopic absorption lines. So it's really fingerprint of chemicals. We see about 600 in pretty much any direction that we look at.
So what sort of distances from Earth would that be?
Well, we see them. It's actually not very dependent on the distance. As soon as between us and the star there is a cloud of interstellar gas and dust present, we actually start seeing them. So even for fairly nearby stars, not the nearest star, because there's just no appreciable amounts of interstellar matter in between us, but for very nearby stars, but also for distant galaxies, we see these fingerprints of these chemicals, and we have not been able to identify these chemicals yet. So we have more than 600 of these lines that are due to some chemical, presumably more than one chemical. The first of these fingerprints was known or discovered in 1922. And so all that time we have been searching for what could be causing these things. So what chemical element are these fingerprints of? And well, we have not been able to identify any of them.
So the mystery just continues to grow.
It's an absolute mystery. But next year we're organizing a conference that hopefully will bring together some of the bright minds in a few different fields and work together towards hopefully identifying before the problem is 100 years old. That's kind of my aim.
Okay, so you've talked about the gas that we can find in the interstellar medium, but also around dying stars. So let's talk a little bit more about that. How do these stars die and then release molecular gas?
Well, so stars can die in a few different ways. And classically, what the distinction that we make is that you have low-mass stars on one side and high-mass stars on the other side.
And the sun is...
The sun would be a low-mass star, okay, yeah. It's a very normal, average type star. High-mass stars would be stars that are 8 or more times as massive as the sun. And they kind of live the fast life. They are heavy fuel consumers. They have a lot of fuel because they're so massive, but they burn through it much faster. And so after a relatively short amount of time, we're still talking about millions and millions of years here, they explode in supernova. That's not mostly what I investigate. I kind of look more at the low mass end of stellar evolution. So stars like the sun, they have a much more gentle way of evolving. They turn into a red giant near the end of their life. And so they swell up to big proportions. So the sun will become as big almost as the Earth's orbit around the sun.
4.5 billion years from now, right?
Something like it, yeah.
Something to look forward to.
Yeah. Of course, the world is not going to survive through December. What is it?
December 2012, of course.
But so those stars, those red giants, that's where a lot of interesting chemistry is happening, because these outer layers, you know, they are only loosely gravitationally bound to the star, and so they gradually, these outer layers get expelled. That's when they get turned into molecules, where dust starts forming, and once dust is formed, the star will actually blow away the dust. It's through a process called radiation pressure, and so the dust is blown away, the gas is dragged along, and so that's how these stars get rid of almost all of their matter near the end of their lives.
They just gradually puff it all away.
It's a process that goes faster and faster and faster, and then the inner core becomes exposed, which is a very hot remnant that's then called a white dwarf. And given the right conditions, and we're not entirely sure what those right conditions necessarily are, but given the right conditions, this white dwarf can illuminate some of this material around, and then we would see that as a planetary nebula. So that's kind of the sort of environments that I think I study most and like studying most.
Now, amongst your research, I saw a reference to something you called weirdos.
Yes,
so I have to ask about that.
Yes, weirdos. Well, the universe is full of weirdos, actually. It's just like on Earth, I guess. It's a term that I coined for a talk when I was a graduate student, actually. So as a graduate student, I got my PhD in Amsterdam, but I spent most of my time actually in Groningen, and the Institute for Astronomy there had two specialties. You had one group working on all the galaxies and galactic stuff, and then you had the group working on low energy astrophysics, infrared observations of young stars, of old stars. That was where we were working with small telescope, ISO 60 centimeter telescope. And they were looking at galaxies with large radio dishes and that sort of things. And so I found that when they would give a talk, we would go to the talk as well, and I found that they often would use these acronyms like EULERX and that sort of things. We didn't have that sort of acronyms. When we gave a talk, we said it was a talk about stellar evolution or about dust formation. They just weren't interested, and they wouldn't show up. And so one time I had to give a talk about this very peculiar binary star, and so I thought, like, well, I'm gonna try and see if I can lure them in. So I'm gonna use,
you need a good acronym,
an acronym, and so I came up with this acronym weirdo. So I said it was a weirdo in the galaxy. So it had two things in my title: it had weirdo in the title, and it had galaxy in the title. And sure enough,
that should do it.
All the people came. So weirdo was then short for wonderfully enigmatic, intriguing, and remarkably different objects. And at that time, there was one of those elements that I would call weirdos. We have found quite a few different objects which are just, where whatever new observation you have, I mean, the way we work is we come up with an ID to explain all the observations that we have, and then to test that our understanding is actually correct, we will propose new observations where we say, like, well, if our understanding is correct, then these new observations will show A. And then we get the new observations, and invariably for these objects, they would show it's totally not A. It can be anything else, but
weird.
Not A. That's sort of a very weird sort of situation.
So are these non-standard planetary nebula?
These are a class of binary stars. And so binaries are interesting because just I guess like life for humans as well, living close with a partner can significantly change the way you evolve and can change your entire life pretty much. And so certainly for close binary stars, a lot of phenomena can happen that completely change the way these stars look like. You know, they can transfer mass from one to the other. And so when the most massive star starts swelling up like a red giant in these close binaries, at that point they start transferring mass to the companion, who was the least massive one, but in a short amount of time, that basically has turned around, right? So now it's the least massive component that suddenly has gained so much mass that it's now a massive star. So that completely changes the way it has to behave, the way it has to evolve.
Now, in terms of planetary nebulas, these, of course, were named back before we knew that they weren't planets, that they were just dying stars. But I do wonder, what happens to the planets around those stars? So when the sun goes through this phase eventually, what will happen to the planets in the solar system?
That's a very good question. So it depends on where the planet is located and how big and massive it is. And so if you look at what the sun will do when it becomes a red giant, as well, if you would be living on Mercury or Venus, that would probably be very bad news, because the sun is going to get bigger than the orbits of those planets. And so those planets would just be swallowed up by the sun, by the expanding sun.
But as that material evaporates away, would they still be there at the end?
Probably not. No. So the temperatures in these red giants are much cooler than the current surface temperature of the sun. So they typically are about 3,000 degrees, but that's still well above the melting points of most minerals and even metals. So when those are gobbled up, they will just slowly melt and then evaporate, and that's going to be the end of it. The planets that are further out, they may survive, but it's not entirely clear how the interaction with for instance, these stellar winds is going to be. So all these stars lose mass at very large rates. Is there a potential that impacts the orbits of the planets or the stability of the orbits of the planets? Well, possibly so. It all depends on exactly how this mass loss is really happening.
So for Earth, we don't exactly know.
For Earth, I am certainly not very optimistic. In the best case, we'll be talking here about a planet where the surface temperature is of the order of 2,000-3,000 degrees. So it's that warmer than I'd be comfortable with.
Of course, Earth will be getting uninhabitably warm well before that anyway. So we'll have to find our own way off, I guess.
That's right. That's right.
Now, you mentioned fullerenes earlier as one of these molecules that you've detected, and it's 60 carbon atoms or so, you said?
Yeah, fullerenes are an entire class of molecules that are recognizable because of their shape. The best known example has indeed 60 carbon atoms and is in the shape of these old-fashioned black and white soccer balls. Yeah, I always have the tendency to say football, because that's how we rightfully call it in Europe, right? So, you know, they have this very round structure. They look exactly like one of these soccer balls. But that's just one member of an entire class of molecules, fullerenes. Are all these molecules that are made of carbon exclusively, but all have this cage-like appearance, typically much larger, maybe a little bit more elongated than the soccer ball. C70, for instance, we have also detected in space. That's more shaped a bit like a rugby ball.
So are they all called, I know the colloquial term is buckyballs, or is that just one of them?
So the buckyballs technically are the C60 species alone.
Okay.
So the real name, when they discovered these species in the laboratory on Earth in 1985, they had to give this substance a name, and they decided to call it Buckminster fullerene. But in their original paper, they actually say that they're a little bit disturbed by that name. It's a mouthful, right? There's a lot of alternatives that they proposed. And for instance, one of the kind of interesting names was Carbo Soccer. Kind of sounds to me like something that Mr. T would say. But...
Okay. So do we find or use these molecules on Earth?
Well, the detection or the discovery of these species on Earth has triggered an avalanche of new research results in nanotechnology. The first thing to realize is that these molecules are extremely stable. And so you can,
that's why we find them in space.
Which is why they survive in space, yeah. Which is why it was also immediately suggested that they could form in space and survive conditions in the interstellar medium, where there's lots of UV radiation trying to destroy an awful lot of other species. But if you think about it, it's shaped like a ball, so you can compress it a little bit, and it can withstand that sort of pressure. So the whole structure of the molecule makes it very, very stable. It also had other unique properties, but further research into these buckyballs or these fullerenes triggered then the detection of or the discovery of things like carbon nanotubes. Of course, carbon nanotubes are a blessing. They're very light, but extremely strong. They're stronger than steel. And they have also very good properties for conducting electricity and good thermal conductivity. So there certainly are promising material. And amongst others, carbon nanotubes are being investigated to use as armor because they are so strong and lightweight. The buckyballs themselves, so the cage molecules, the C60, they have some interesting properties as well. And one of the things people have been trying to do is, and they have managed now, by the way, you can open up with the proper chemicals, you can open up the top part of this ball, you can put in a water molecule, then close it again, or put a stopper on, and then, you know, given the right chemicals, you can open it up again. And so it's something that researchers are looking for, where it could improve targeted drug therapy, for instance, where you open up this gate and release drugs wherever they need to be.
So what do we learn by observing them in space?
That's a good question. The first thing that we learn is that, well, these molecules can self-assemble in space. And it's something that was predicted 25 years ago when they were discovered in laboratories on Earth. The whole idea, the whole experiment in which they were discovered was aimed to understand certain aspects of the chemistry going on around these sort of evolved stars, and especially the class of evolved stars, which is very rich in carbon. And what they were trying to do is to prove that you could easily make these very long carbon chains, and that those would be stable enough to survive into the interstellar medium. And what came out of those experiments was that spontaneously you can actually form that sort of very different sort of molecules, spherically shaped like the C60 and the C70. So the way to get there was to increase the pressure so that there's lots of collisions going on between the particles. And so the reason why the C60 and the C70 came out is that those were the ones that survived. So it really was a survival, the fittest game they were playing, and the fittest that survived were C60 and C70. Now, if you see a molecule which has this complex structure like a soccer ball, you know, you can sit at home and you can think like, gosh, you know, it's quite impressive that these chemists can be there in their lab kind of carefully assembling an atom, a carbon atom at a time to make a
self-assemble.
But they self-assemble, that's right. And so This is what I find so beautiful about astrophysics, right? Astrophysics is you take physics that you know from home, garden, and kitchen use, and now you apply it to conditions in space. And if conditions are similar things should come out in the end. And we see over and over again that actually seems to work. Sometimes we have to adjust our understanding a little bit because conditions in space are actually quite different from most of the conditions that we can even create on Earth. But so in this case, the prediction was that if you find a proper environment which is carbon rich, where the survival of the fittest also plays a role, you should be able to form these structures in space as well. And so that was a prediction from 25 years ago. And for 25 years, people searched for it but couldn't find it. And so you start wondering, well, is there something about the physics or something about the chemistry that we have misunderstood or misinterpreted? Should we change our understanding of carbon chemistry or what's really going on? So I think when we discovered these buckyballs, the first thing is like, well, we have found at least an environment where you make them. And gosh, fortunately, Mother Nature can make these things without the chemists, you know, intervening. Unless, of course, there are lots of chemists around there making these buckyballs. So I think that was an interesting aspect of finding them. I think the future is even more interesting because now we know that they exist, and in the meantime they have been found in a lot of different environments, actually in a lot of planetary nebula already, but also in young stars. They've also been found in star forming regions in the interstellar medium. So we know that they exist in a lot of different places, and then there's a lot of other places where we don't see them. You see them in all the young planetary nebula, for instance, but a little bit older planetary nebula, we don't see them. Why exactly is that? Well, we have a few ideas, but one of the elements that probably plays a role is that there's chemistry going on with these C60 species. So there
might
be...
get used up.
Yeah, they might be you know, catalysts for formation of all sorts of other species. And so if you throw some other species to a buckyball, it can stick, right? And what you are left with is not a buckyball anymore. And see, we wouldn't see that as a buckyball anymore necessarily. So there's a lot of things that could be going on there as well. At the same time, these fullerenes have properties that are very similar to another class of molecules called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAS for short. They kind of look like chicken wire cut in pieces. So it's all these hexagonal carbon-based flat sort of molecules. And we think that those are amongst the most abundant reservoirs of organic material. So it's estimated that up to maybe 15% of all the carbon in the entire universe is contained in that sort of molecules. We have not been able to identify a single of those paths in space yet, but we know that they have very similar properties to these fullerenes, and we also find them in some of the environments where we have also found the fullerenes. And so we can now use these fullerenes to study the environment and see how that sort of molecules react in that sort of environment, and then see at all the emission features that we see from these paths, how do they respond, and what does that tell us about these molecules? And maybe if we take that road, we can finally identify some of these PAS molecules.
So it's a big complex story up there, and there's still a lot unknown, but it sounds like we're learning an awful lot.
Absolutely, very complex story, but it's an interesting one, and it's one which also might be relevant for life on Earth. If you think about it, if you look at meteorites, you find a lot of complex molecules in these meteorites. So you can
organic molecules.
Yeah, that's right. So pretty much all amino acids that you need for life on Earth, you also find in meteorites. So it's telling you that up there, conditions are such that you can make some of these complex ingredients for life. Well, that's useful. You know, that's maybe that nature is helping life ahead and kickstarts it on Earth, right? By making sure that some of these steps, which would take a long time on Earth to actually make these and these and these chemicals, you can now make in space, deliver them to the Earth with meteorites, comets and asteroid bombardments. And so who knows, maybe there's some relevance for life on Earth.
That's fantastic. Okay, so Dr. Kamen, that was extremely fascinating stuff. I look forward to hearing more in the future. And thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
We just listened to Dave's interview with Dr. Kemi, and he works mostly in astrochemistry, which is a very interesting field, relating it to planetary science, the fact that molecules can be found everywhere. Most interesting is the molecules that are out of these stars when they die, and they are spread out in the interstellar medium, which is the space between the stars, and then things like meteorites and comets might have these kinds of molecules. It's a very interesting topic.
Well, there's a kind of galactic gardening that happens, right? These molecules are drifting around in space, but at some point they'll probably be incorporated into a star and its planetary system, and we may find living things trying to make use of them.
So this is my favorite thing to tell students when I go into the classrooms, is that everyone is made of stardust, and it's very exciting for them to learn about the whole process of stellar evolution and how planets can be created out of those molecules that the stars created generations ago.
You can be certain about it, right? I mean, there are little or no amount of heavy elements, where we're talking heavier than helium, are formed at the start of the universe, and everything else has to be processed through stars and their whole life cycle. If you've got anything in your body heavier than maybe lithium, you've definitely got it secondhand from the stars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very interesting to see how, well, it's normally called an onion shell in the star. It's very interesting to see how these elements form under such different temperatures and pressure, and how just by, you know, looking at the spectra or just like studying from far, you can get so much information about the place where it's formed, the kind of temperature, what kind of other elements are present there, what kind of processes it goes through during the evolution. It's very interesting to know, you know, those kind of elements are not just found anywhere. They come from the star.
And one thing I found interesting that he said in the interview was that if a star is in a binary system, how it can affect those things, and how stars can actually behave quite differently if they're in a different system like that. So these are what he was calling the weirdos, right?
Right.
The binary system are very interesting in a way that if one has a disk, let's say circumstellar disks from which these, hopefully, the planets form, their material would be changed or transferred to the other companion by having another star in the system. Studying such systems can really help us understand how planets form around the stars, which actually have a binary companion, because we actually have found planets that are present around these binary companion stars. And it's just bizarre to, you know, think about planets that can survive. Think about living on such a planet, how you have two stars. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a sun, and sun A and a sun B when you wake up in the morning. Obviously, the dynamics and the astrochemistry going around that would be completely different, because now you have two different stars. One might be a young star, the other one in the companion might be a giant star. You never know. There can be a lot of different binary companions, and just the chemistry around them can be so much more different compared to just our own sun or a standalone star.
Mm-hmm.
And also follow up on that, even if there's life form, some kind of life form on that planet, and it will be interesting to see how it adapts to two suns or two stars, how it biologically adapts to day and night, because I would imagine the nighttime will be really, really short.
Right. Well, there's this book,
it depends on how far apart the two stars are.
Yeah.
And also, life will evolve from such a...
So there's this short story that Isaac Asimov wrote, which is called Nightfall, and it's all about that. It's about this civilization that lives in a solar system that has four suns, And they talk about, in the beginning of the book, it's coming to the point where they're all going to set. And it's going to, the planet's going to go into darkness for the first time in 2,000 years. And so it's this whole big, like, oh my gosh, the world's going to end, right? Because this only happens every 2,000 years. So only the scientists really understand why it's happening. And really, it's kind of like exaggerated version of December 21st, 2012, doomsday here, or, you know, that we have.
Solar eclipses when the dragon ate the sun.
Right. Yeah. So it's an interesting story.
Yeah, you can imagine all kinds of bizarre environments. And when you think about the sort of ecosystem chemistry of, is there a binary companion? Are there metal-rich molecular clouds hanging about in the environment? What kind of pressure waves and gravitational disturbances are mixing that stuff up when the star is being born? And then the dynamics, which we still don't understand, of how things get distributed and mixed and spread in the protostellar nebula. Trying to understand all of the different ways that those can turn into planetary systems that can have stories to write about is an interesting kind of diversity.
It's also very interesting to see, I think Jan talked about this in his interview, that how some planets might and some might not survive after the protoplanetary nebula phase. Jan actually talked about one of the most interesting aspects that I love is after the planetary nebula phase, if any of the planets actually survived, not all the planets would survive. For example, us being on Earth, as he said, would be too hot for us to live here, or we might not even exist at that point. It is very interesting to see, just by studying the astrochemistry, there is so much, not only you learn about the stars, but you also learn about the system that can form and that might or might not survive after such phases. And we, as in civilization, might not exist a few thousand years, a few billion years from now, because our own sun might go through that phase. Just looking at the other stars, which actually have planets, they would go through this phase, what lives and what doesn't live. It's very interesting to see how astrochemistry points in so many different directions.
Mm-hmm. Haven't there been planets found around a neutron star? I seem to remember something like
that.
I think the first planet was actually found around the neutron star.
So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the supernova explosion that would leave a remnant as a neutron star is a lot more energetic than the planetary nebula phase, which you talked about. So the fact that there was still a planet left over in that is pretty spectacular.
Yeah, never mind the warming planet that comes with the main sequence, right?
Yeah.
That's going to be a real bad day when your star goes nova.
Yeah, supernova.
There have also been ideas thrown in for the neutron star that it's possible that those were the nomad planets that were actually just floating around in space that were actually captured by... Well, these are just ideas. I mean, people are working on it. It's probably not a theory till now, but it's highly possible because you never know what's out there.
You never know. I guess it depends on the orbit, right? I mean, if it's relatively circular, I would assume that would be pretty hard to capture something like that into that kind of orbit.
That's not a likely outcome of a capture.
Jeez, we're getting into another doomsday topic with the rogue planets now, right? Don't worry, everyone. The world's not going to end.
Well, yeah, and you should worry about Earth on the scale of billions of years.
Right.
I mean, I have become quite attached to this planet. It looks like it's only got a few billion to go.
About halfway through, though, so
yeah.
I think we'll be okay.
Well, maybe we've got time to sort out a plan.
Probably have engineers working on hopping onto other planets and planets in the other solar system.
Yeah.
So hopefully within the next billion years or so, we'll find a way to transport
ourselves.
Even
Mars will be far enough away.
Well, yeah,
it?
And the nice thing is that solar power becomes much more economically viable. It's not twice as bright.
Yes.
But before that, I don't think the sun is the greatest threat. I think, like, asteroids crashing into Earth is more dangerous.
Luckily, we have our tracking systems that track everything of kilometer size or larger. At least we'll know 30 to 40 years in advance.
Hopefully, yeah. You know, in any case, threat or not, it's impressive to me just how much we can tell by looking at fine little lines in spectroscopes. Extrapolate the history of molecular clouds and of stars and of how we fit into that and how, in the evolution of our stellar system, is one example of a lot of different ways that things can evolve.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Dave Kirsch. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Zengi Hu, Raymond Francis, Parshadi Patel, and Alyssa Gilbert. Our editors were Mariam Tabishian, Michelle Parsons, John Moores, and Michael Forster. And, as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.